KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
When they start getting into officers' rights, when they start getting into disciplinary changes, those things have traditionally always been bargained, and we want them to be bargained going forward.
It all depends what one's level of consciousness is before one really begins to comprehend heaven and hell.
It is clearly not the most appropriate place to treat patients. Whether it's dangerous, I don't think so. I mean, they are in an emergency department.
Imam Jamal Rahman of the Interfaith Amigos talking about heaven and hell. Rich O'Neill talking about the Seattle Police Guild and the Seattle Police Officers' concern over the police reform plan. And the Department of Social and Health Services, Jane Beyer, on the practice of psychiatric boarding. Issues we take up today. On weekday, I'm Steve Scher. What happens to psychiatric patients when there aren't enough beds in community centers or at the state's mental health hospitals? They can end up in emergency rooms. And if that happens, they might not receive adequate mental health treatment during that time. They do have a bed to sleep in, though. It's a practice known as psychiatric boarding. According to a recent decision by the Pierce County Superior Court, that's unacceptable. The state will challenge that ruling. The problem is there aren't always enough beds in treatment centers or at the state hospital, and sometimes the mental health system has to turn to the ER rather than turn a person out into the street. Jane Beyer leads Behavioral Health and Service Integration Administration at DSHS.
Psychiatric boarding is a practice that occurs inside of our involuntary treatment system. There is a specific statutory scheme and system that comes into play when an individual's mental illness is so severe that they are a danger to themselves or others, or they are so gravely disabled that they're unable to meet their own needs. And in those cases, an individual can be detained for an initial period of 72 hours, and then if a county-designated mental health professional determines that the individual or believes that the individual meets the commitment standard, can petition the court for a 14-day detention to further evaluate and attempt to stabilize the individual. And this is all involuntary. Generally, as the system is designed, individuals who are in that situation being held for either 72 hours or 14 days would be served at an evaluation and treatment facility, which could either be a freestanding facility in the community or could be a part of a hospital. When there are not sufficient evaluation and treatment facility beds in a community, and an individual is detained for evaluation by a mental health professional, sometimes that happens at the emergency room of a hospital. And that is what psychiatric boarding is.
So a court case that comes up and has this ruling by the Pierce County Superior Court Commissioner is saying that if there are not beds available, institutions still have to figure out a way to treat the mentally ill. Has that not been happening?
In emergency rooms, individuals are probably being stabilized with medication, we hope, being seen by a psychiatrist, but it is not the level of treatment that one would receive if one were in an evaluation and treatment facility.
I mean, this Superior Court Commissioner Craig Adams is saying that the mentally ill are being parked in hospital emergency rooms without appropriate treatment, and he said that violates state and federal laws. Do you agree with that?
Well, Commissioner Adams' ruling is being, we would call it an appeal. A motion has been filed asking a Superior Court judge to overturn the commissioner's decision by the Pierce County prosecutor, and the state will be seeking to intervene in that case.
To what end? What's the outcome that the state would like to see?
The state is questioning the ruling that invalidates our rule called single bed certification that allows an individual to be cared for in an emergency room or in an inpatient bed in a hospital as an alternative to a freestanding evaluation and treatment facility or an inpatient psych unit in a community hospital. Given the fact that the alternative to the single bed certification would be to have the person be back out on the street, which we do not believe is the right thing to do to people.
It sounds like it's a necessary tool because of the number of people needing service.
Yes.
Is it dangerous for patients?
I would say that it is clearly not the most appropriate place to treat patients. Whether it's dangerous, I don't think so. I mean, they are in an emergency department. There are legitimate concerns that the hospitals raise about having these individuals in their emergency departments, especially when you've got nurses who are not psych nurses. They're emergency nurses. They're trauma nurses. But the individual is not out on the street, and most importantly, they are not putting themselves or others at risk. And the thing that the least desirable result that we want for anybody who's mentally ill is to end up in the criminal justice system.
Well, that's the other way we've dealt with boarding mentally ill, isn't it?
It is. Mental illness is a big issue in our jails, indeed, and in our criminal justice system. And as we've had discussions about whether Washington State should adopt the Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act, one of the factors that we've discussed is the fact that if we can help young people, young single people who now are not eligible for Medicaid, gain access to Medicaid coverage so that we can help them before they go into crisis or before we commit a crime, we would hope that we'll be able to use those opportunities to avoid both involuntary commitment and people being arrested for conduct that's related to their mental illness.
Jane Beyer is with Behavior Health and Service at DSHS. You know, I read a quote from State Senator Mike Carroll, mm-hmm. who's the chair of the Senate Human Services and Corrections Committee. He was saying that we haven't had a full makeover of the mental health system since 1989, when management of the outpatient system was farmed out to counties. It's time for another makeover. Is he right?
We have been working with Senator Carroll, and we are aware of his desire to have a task force. He is correct that the last major reforms in the mental health system were in 1989, and we have worked with him, and actually the piece of legislation, if a task force is established, we will be more than willing to participate in it in good faith. We will bring what resources and what data we have to the table to help those deliberations. The legislation that task force is in actually also includes legislation that the department requested that relates to trying to move both our mental health and our drug treatment systems, alcohol and drug treatment systems, to, number one, focus more on the outcomes that are most important to clients, which are things like, am I involuntarily committed? Do I end up in the criminal justice system? Do I end up in the emergency room? Which, of course, we want to say we reduce the extent to which that happens. And can I be employed? Can I be stably housed? Are my mental health symptoms under control, which we want to increase? And then also to have our systems rely more on treatment methods that the research shows us work.
Well, you have you have a whole series of folks that are testifying in Olympia on a package mm-hmm. of bills. What would they accomplish that, what you're talking about, and would it cost very much in this current budget cycle? Therefore, would it be funded?
That is a major question. I think the biggest question that challenges the legislature is if there is a fixed amount of money to invest in the mental health system, what is the best way to invest those dollars? And the legislation that's before the legislature at this point, the number of bills, many of which have passed out of their respective houses and are now over in the opposite house, some deal with the issues related to, as we just discussed, sort of redesigning the system to be more accountable for outcomes. Others deal with particular aspects of the civil commitment system or the relationship between the civil system and the criminal justice system. For all of those, I think it's a matter of the legislature stepping back and trying to decide where they want to invest funding in mental health. Do you want to invest it in, for example, upfront intensive services in the community, like crisis triage, crisis stabilization, a program called the Program for Assertive Community Treatment, to try to treat people so that they don't have to be involuntary committed or so that they don't end up in the criminal justice system? Or do you invest more in services like building evaluation and treatment beds so that if somebody is involuntarily detained, there's an appropriate place to care for them?
And that's not an emergency room of a hospital?
Correct. It would be assuming that it's an evaluation and treatment facility, which is designed to care for people who are in mental health crisis and need to be evaluated and stabilized.
I'm sure that building a facility like that would be expensive.
There are capital costs associated with it, and the costs of operating a facility like that are costly, too, because you need to have psychiatry, you need to have medical services, you need to have nursing, and other individuals who... It's a pretty intensive staffing model because you're working with people who have pretty intensive care needs.
That was Jane Byer. She leads Behavioral Health and Service Integration Administration at the Department of Social and Health Services. We tried to talk to nurses and hospital administrators about their safety concerns with the practice of psychiatric boarding. But the people we talked to told us they couldn't be available to comment today. They're all in Olympia, testifying on a number of mental health bills that are making their way through the legislature. Some, as you heard, could have an impact on this practice. This is Weekday.
KUOW 94.9, it's 9:17.
Support for KUOW comes from the structural engineering firm of Swenson Say Faget, with offices in Seattle and Tacoma, working collaboratively with architects, contractors, and homeowners, as well as public and private sector clients, to create effective building solutions. More information at SwensonSayFaget.com.
Did you know you can name KUOW as a beneficiary in your insurance policy or individual retirement accounts, and that you might be eligible for additional financial benefits as well? The next time you review your long-term financial plans, consider including KUOW. For more information, go to kuow.org/support-future.
52 degrees in Seattle. Today's high in the mid to upper 50s. Rain expected. Tonight, a low around 48 with a 50-50 chance of rain. And on Thursday, a high again in the mid to upper 50s. Cloudy. Rain likely Thursday afternoon. The three Interfaith Amigos talk about heaven and hell. That's about 15 minutes away.
Yesterday, a U.S. judge approved the Seattle Police Monitor's reform plan. The reform plan stems from findings by the Department of Justice that Seattle police officers routinely use excessive force, and they found there was evidence of bias in SPD practices. The decision by the judge comes a day after the Seattle Police Officers Guild and Seattle Police Management Association came out saying they wanted some clarity in the plan
and its impact on collective bargaining, raising some concerns that there may be language that violates collective bargaining rights for police officers. Merrick Bobb is court-appointed monitor. He tracks the police department's progress on reforms implemented under the consent decree between the city and the Department of Justice. He joins us on the phone. Merrick Bobb, thanks for talking to us.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be here. It's a good day.
Also with us is Joe Brand. He's senior police expert of the Monitor team, former police chief in Haywood, California, and the first director of the Justice Department's Office of Community-Oriented Policing Services. Joe Brand, thanks for talking to us.
Good morning, and thank you.
And Peter Ehrlichman, Seattle attorney and the deputy monitor. Peter Ehrlichman, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
So, Merrick Bobb, the federal judge, in making his announcement yesterday, he says he praised your work. He had some warnings for the city going forward, which we'll get to. But overall, he accepted your deadlines for implementing new policies. What is the next step?
Well, with the monitoring plan now approved and in place, the next step is to begin very seriously examining the practices of the Seattle Police Department and compare them to the settlement agreement and see whether the police department is on its way to full compliance with the settlement agreement. And to that end, I'm meeting with the city officials. I meet with community members, indeed, in about 45 minutes. We're meeting with a host of community members and organizations to get continuing feedback from the community. We had feedback from the court yesterday. We've had feedback from the city attorney, from the mayor, from city council. So we think we're poised really now to get down to brass tacks and look seriously at the department and to do so with input from all in a collaborative way.
Now, the agreement outlines dates, pretty specific dates, by which the next few steps go through. One of the things is happening by June 30th is a meeting of the Use of Force Committee. That's one of the first things on your list. Training curricula soon after that. What is the, for example, the Use of Force Committee? What does that entail? What's supposed to happen by June 30th?
Use of force, of course, is the key issue here. In your introduction, you adverted to the findings of the Department of Justice. And what the settlement agreement requires is a wholesale change in the way that force is defined, trained, and used on the street. There will be a whole raft of new policies touching on use of force and also touching on crisis intervention, the ability of the police to deal better with situations involving the homeless, the mentally ill, the emotionally unstable, and people in a behavioral crisis. And we are going to be getting and considering drafts, policies in all of those areas to see whether they comport with the settlement agreement and to see whether they incorporate best practice. There is nothing in the settlement agreement and nothing that the monitoring team will do that will be at variance with what is a consensus around the country of what best practice is. We will be observing the Use of Force Review Board and the Firearms Review Board to see how the department itself comes to grips with or grapples with issues of force, whether they are analyzing them correctly, whether they are giving the training and teaching that's necessary, and also whether they are considering force in such a way as to reinforce the message throughout the department that previous practices are no longer to be tolerated, and that there will be a new way of relating with the community as a whole.
The go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh, those. I was just saying that community relations is such a big part of what we are going to be doing and looking at. The Seattle Police Department needs the support of all the varied communities in Seattle. Similarly, the communities in Seattle, all of them, need the protection of the police department. So that relationship between the police department and the varied and diverse communities in Seattle is going to be a key indicator. If that relationship improves, then we will know things are getting better.
And what's the way you judge that?
We judge that by meeting frequently with community, by having some of the monitoring team that we've assembled specifically charged with working with and dealing with the various communities, by taking surveys, as we intend to do, by looking at the degree of cooperation between the communities and the police, by looking at clearance rates on crimes, and generally looking at the degree to which the police are responsive to the needs and desires of the community and are guided by the community, at least in part with respect to how they police, who they police, and in what manner they police.
You know, before on that note, and before I turn to your colleagues for some more specifics, Merrick Bob, the people who are nominated to be on the Community Police Commission went before the City Council. How important is it to have this commission up and running, and when do they need to be up and running in order to help with the monitor's job?
Yesterday. We need them immediately empowered, affirmed, confirmed, and going, because they play a vital role. The Community Police Commission plays a very vital role. They will be the entity that weighs in on and helps determine whether there's going to be reform of the disciplinary system, whether there is going to be reform of the way in which citizens' complaints are investigated. They're going to be looking at entities like the OPA that investigates police misconduct through complaints. They're going to be weighing in on how the department deals with discriminatory policing and what data the department collects in that area. So they are crucial, and I strongly support early confirmation of that commission, and I'm eager, as well as all my monitoring team, to begin working with them.
Well, besides using the bully pulpit here, what can the monitor do to move that process further along faster?
Yeah, the monitor is does not particularly have a bully pulpit. The monitor is a creature of the federal court.
I meant this bully pulpit.
And it is the court ultimately that determines whether the department is making sufficient progress. And if you listen carefully to Judge Robart in his comments yesterday, you will see that he is not going to abide a lot of monkey business. He is there to oversee the implementation of this agreement, to see it implemented as rapidly as possible, and to use the powers and inherent in the federal judiciary and in the law to move things along.
All right, let me ask you. I'm going to come back to the monkey business part of this in a moment, but let me ask Joe Braun, as somebody who has worked on these ideas around the state, you and your colleagues, and I imagine you would be part of that. You've met with SPD at the different precincts. What within your role as a consultant here, what have you seen that would you like to move most quickly on in seeing the police department change some practices?
Well, the issues that have been identified in the consent decree and the agreement are all equally important, to be quite honest with you. The fact is that there are certain things that are very specific about the use of force issues, the training aspects related to that, things that are related to the review process, the investigation, management accountability. Those, if I was to put something at the top of the list, I guess I would really say that focusing on the use of force, because that was primarily driving the agreement, the investigation in the first place, the issue of certain training that's going to be necessary in relation to the development of the new policies, new protocols, things that the department is actually already working on. I would put that at the top of the list, coupled with a focus on how the organization can improve management accountability, management performance with respect to the review, and ensuring that the policies, the training are clearly understood. And in fact, ultimately, the proof is in the pudding. It's the behavior on the street. It's the consistency of the officer's performance with those policies, with those protocols, and the expectations that are being established.
You know, when you look at this chart, the chart for compliance here, stops and detention policy 12/31/13, deadline for compliance. Does that mean we'll see changes in the police department actions that come back to training, of course, by the end of this year?
That's the objective. The department indicated as well that they want to be very aggressive in moving forward with this. And I can tell you, in terms of my own experience and working with other organizations and having overseen consent decrees, that one thing that is a good sign, a good indication at this stage, is the department is not sitting on their laurels at this stage. They're trying to move forward aggressively with the development of the new policies, the refinements of the policies, training plans. They're anxious to get those established and to actually begin the implementation process. And in some other instances around the country, there are a number of notable examples where these things have lagged for years. Hopefully we're not going to encounter that here.
All right, well, let me ask the three of you, and you guys will decide who weighs in here, otherwise I'll direct it, just to respond to a couple of things here. So on Monday, the Seattle Police Guild and the Seattle Police Management Association filed a brief in Superior Court asking for protection of their collective bargaining rights. And in their press release, they said the monitoring team, however, has given indications they do not intend to follow the bargaining process set forth in the state collective bargaining laws. Our organizations are troubled by this, and it appears to violate state law, has ramifications that could affect our members' collective bargaining rights. And I talked to Rich O'Neill, the president of the Seattle Police Guild, and he told me in conversation he found the monitor and the staff very professional. He felt that they felt very good. There were very few things to argue about. He commended the monitor staff for acknowledgement that SPD was understaffed. They need more supervisors, better officer training. But he said the unions have to draw the line where reforms would clash with officer rights.
We are not opposed, and I want to say it again, we are not opposed to reforms. We're not opposed to reforming our use of force policies. And we are not opposed to any more training, but we just want those issues that the courts have long ago determined to be a mandatory subject of bargaining in this state to be respected while the monitoring team operates in this state. I want things to be examined from all angles. You know, we have nothing to fear there. The officers do their job, and they do it well. When an officer does not do their job well, they should face sanction. But what those sanctions would be, how the sanctions are carried out, the process, those are all outlined in our collective bargaining agreement. And if they want to change those, that's what needs to be bargained.
Merrick Bob, is there conflict here?
Let me say that we extend our hand to Rich O'Neill and are happy to talk to him about any of these issues. I'm going to turn it over to Peter Ehrlichman, who can amplify on this.
Peter?
The thing that Merrick Bob has emphasized and that the entire team has implemented is a relationship-building process with all of the constituents, including the unions that are affected by this. And we have met on several occasions with Sergeant O'Neill and with his counterpart of the command union. And we enjoy, I think, the beginnings of a good relationship, and we hope to capitalize on this. But to quote Judge Robart yesterday, the lawsuit which the unions brought against the city and named Merrick Bob as a defendant is a, quote, further distraction, close quote, from this process. And since Merrick Bob is an agent of the federal court, again, to quote Judge Robart, it seems inappropriate that the union would take the action that it's taken by commencing suit against a federal agent.
Does this suit slow down the process?
We're not going to let it slow down the process. In fact, that would be contrary to everything that we're all about, and it would be contrary to the direction given to us by Judge Robart. It's also contrary to what people of goodwill in this city want to see. They want to see change and movement as quickly as possible, including the Seattle Police Department. The officers, the command staff of the department need to be commended for the efforts that they have undertaken so far to accept the need for change and reform and to work hard to see that change is implemented. So we're not going to let this lawsuit, as much of a distraction as it may try to be, stop us from doing what we need to do.
All right. I'll leave it there. A lot more questions to ask, but maybe you guys will talk to us again in the days and weeks ahead. I appreciate you taking the time now.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're part of Seattle. We'll remain available to you. Just give us a holler.
All right, we will. Thank you very much. Joe Braun is senior police expert on the monitor team. Peter Ehrlichman is Seattle attorney, deputy monitor. Merrick Bob is the court-appointed monitor, tracking police department progress on reforms implemented under the consent decree between the city and the Department of Justice.
It's 9:37, KULW 94.9. The Catholic Church could name a new pope any time now. So what kind of pope would you like to see? Let us know at 206-221-3663. That's 206-221-3663. We'll talk about it on The Conversation today at 12:20.
For KUOW comes from Sutter Home and Hearth, providing homeowners with gas and wood-burning fireplaces and stoves using heating technology designed with energy efficiency in mind. In Seattle and on the web at sutterhearth.com.
52 degrees in Seattle with a projected high today of 57, rain in the forecast as well. Tonight, expect a low around 48, a 50-50 chance of rain. Thursday's high again around 57 with clouds and rain likely in the afternoon.
Support for KUOW comes from Alaska USA Federal Credit Union. For more than three generations, Alaska USA members have shared the goal of helping each other get places worth going with savings accounts, loans, investments, insurance policies, and more. On the web at alaskausa.org.
We'll get the latest news from Canada, courtesy of Vaughn Palmer. That's this morning at 10:05.
Imam Jamal Rahman, Rabbi Ted Falcon, Pastor Don McKenzie, the three interfaith amigos have been talking to Katie Sewell about heaven and hell.
That's right. We discussed mortality. We discussed mortality last month, and so we thought, let's go a little deeper. Heaven and hell, how important is that concept to religious traditions and How does it actually pertain to the non-religious? I started by having them sort out the differences between Christianity, Judaism, and Islam when they talk about heaven and hell, and Imam Jamal Rahman started the discussion.
You know, it's interesting that the Quran says that before there will be this opportunity to go to heaven or hell, Prophet Jesus will come down to earth and establish a period of justice and mercy, and that'll be a sign that end times are coming. Then there is a day of judgment, and then people are divided into ranks of going into the area of heaven and hell. That's a literal understanding. But the Quran suggests there are many more levels of understanding. So, for example, a day of judgment, a verse in the Quran says, and piercing will be your sight, meaning it's a time of astounding awareness to learn from your mistakes, which you did not so well on earth. You have a chance now to really become aware of that and really purify yourself. Then heaven, you know, sensual pleasures, luxurious gardens, flowing rivers. But a verse in the Quran says what really is going to give you that sense of bliss is proximity to God, the good pleasure of God. That's supreme felicity, meaning heaven is just a way station. The journey continues. And in Islamic tradition, in the seven levels of heaven, towards union with God. And then there is hell, scorching fire, boiling water. But as I said last month, a verse in the Quran says, "Your hell is like your mother," meaning those who didn't do well, whose quantity of good deeds were little, they have a chance now to purify themselves, to go in the womb and come out renewed. So in that sense, hell is less a place of punishment than it is of purification. It all depends what one's level of consciousness is before one really begins to comprehend heaven and hell. And unfortunately, we are using the faculties of the five, six senses. And we know there is traffic and trade in those mysterious realms, but it's like using a bamboo stick to measure the depth of the ocean.
Pastor Don McKenzie, what does Christianity say about heaven?
Well, I think in many ways I agree with what Imam Jamal has said, that in terms of there are so many different levels. The words heaven and hell do appear in the Gospels and the epistles. But they circle around a larger question. Well, a couple of questions. One is, what is the meaning of life between birth and death? Is there anything beyond? And is there any relationship between what we do between birth and death and what happens beyond? And the institution of the church has at times used the idea of good behavior as a promise of something good happening. That is, that when the body dies, the soul would find some kind of healing or pleasure or something. But I think that, as Jamal said so well, that it depends on your level of consciousness. How are you understanding these words and so forth? And I think traditionally the words have been understood at a pretty concrete level that requires a higher level of consciousness to see those larger questions that I think these two words, heaven, hell, surround. I don't think that Jesus would have said a person would be punished eternally, nor do I think Jesus would ever have said there is anything like eternal bliss. How boring could that be? I think we are continuing to evolve between birth and death, and I think what makes sense to me is that after the death of the body, there is some continuing evolution, yeah, that requires effort and intention and some kind of help from other beings and so forth.
How about you, Rabbi Ted Falcon?
You know the old saying, where there are two Jews, there are three opinions. Over the course of Jewish history, there have been many different takes on what afterlife is about, what life is about. It's very hard for us to understand, but in biblical times, the focus was not on the individual. It was on the community. So the continuity was perceived to be a continuity of community rather than a continuity of individuality. Somewhere around the first century, the core of that time, there was a major shift of consciousness. I frankly think that Jesus was part of that, that awakened to the significance of the individual as opposed to the corporate, to the tribal. And then the issue became, does the individual continue after death? Because that's a very different thing than does the tribe continue after death. And then you get the issue of which part of the individual? Like, are we talking about the ego part? Are we talking about the spiritual part? Because we live on a multidimensional reality when we are walking the earth. And the general tendency is to see what survives as the soul and the degree to which we are attuned to the soul levels, which is to say, we are open to love, we are open to compassion, we are open to justice. We are less looking to build up our own ego, to build up our own fame, to build up our own treasure chest, and more open to supporting others and to being in connection with a greater love and a greater compassion. To that extent, we are already living beyond our earthly existence while we're on the planet. One of the cute things is that everybody seems to define heaven as what they would most like to do. So for the rabbis, heaven was being able to study Torah all the time. And they saw that as the greatest joy that they could possibly have. But for the regular layperson, that doesn't sound real good. It's like the image of playing harps and, you know, sitting on clouds. It's like, do you really want to do that? So ultimately, the course of Jewish history has defined that which happens after life to pretty much depend on that which happened during life. And to the extent to which we are awake to the more spiritual dimensions of our existence, we will have more of an awareness, a self-awareness, after leaving the body. And we will have a greater capacity to continue our journey consciously. One of the things that strikes me always is when a great artist dies, all of a sudden it's possible to appreciate that person's art or that person's music in ways that it couldn't be experienced when that person was alive. And it seems to me that part of that person's being freed from the confines of the body is available for everyone. Mm-hmm. And in Jewish tradition, the tzaddik, the righteous teacher who lives a life dedicated to spirituality, when such a person dies, that part of that person is available to all of us in a more expansive way than it was even available while that person was confined to a body.
We're exploring the concept of the afterlife with the three interfaith amigos. That was Rabbi Ted Falcon you just heard. We're also here with Pastor Don McKenzie and Imam Jamal Rahman. So how important is the concept of the afterlife, that something happens after we die, to spirituality or religions in general? Is that what the whole idea hinges on?
You know, if we overemphasize the concept and idea of heaven and earth, it can also distort our conduct, our attitude, our deeds in this world. There's a story in Islamic spirituality that Prophet Jesus came upon two groups of people who were crippled, who were afflicted, and who were burdened with anxiety and worries. And Prophet Jesus said, "What is your affliction?" And one group said, "We are so eager. We have this acute urgency to enjoy the sensual pleasures of heaven. We cannot wait." And this is what makes us so crippled. The other group said, "We are so scared and we have such dread of hell that we are burdened, we are afflicted, and we are crippled." So an overemphasis on heaven and earth, on reward and punishment, can distort our actions in this world.
It's interesting, the image of both people being in the same situation but interpreting it so differently fits one of the rabbinic images of heaven and hell. One of the rabbis, very righteous person, wanted to be shown what it was like in heaven and what it was like in hell. And in hell, there's a beautiful, beautiful feast. And he says, what is the thing here. This is all this wonderful food for these people. And the angel says, well, look more carefully. The people can't bend their elbows. They can't. They reach out. They take food. They can't eat it. And he goes to heaven, and he finds the same scene. There's the buffet table. The people, he says, they can't move their elbows either. And the angel says, yes, but watch. In heaven, they feed each other. Mm. So it's the same.
Yes.
It's the same thing. It's just like our lives. Uh-huh. The crises, the difficulties, the conflicts we have in our life, either are those things which we realize are opportunities to connect on a more spiritual level, to grow ourselves, or they are like battering rams that just lead us into great pain, great suffering, great self-disparagement. The same things.
Don?
I think part of the need to have these images of heaven and hell has to do with the need to say, I'm better than another person. I'm going to be okay if I do X, Y, and Z. But I think Scripture tells us in all of our traditions that our beings, the substance of our beings cannot be altered. I mean, we do bad things. We have bad things. We think bad things. But those things can be separated from our beings. And so when I think of something like the Day of Judgment, which is a very strong image in Christian tradition, I don't think of bad people being burned forever and good people enjoying some kind of bliss. I think of a separation between our beings and the evil that we are always vulnerable to. I see that drifting away, but not without effort on our part, because spiritual growth is, in all of our traditions, clearly one of the most important things. And if we simply focus on if we're good, we go to heaven, if we're bad, we go to hell, we can actually bypass the substance of that. We will not even get to anywhere near the kind of consciousness we need to think about how we should be in this life in terms of helping each other in community, or even our own responsibility as individuals to grow spiritually and to open our hearts to the lives of other people.
Now, a lot of people listening who aren't members of a religion would think that they have that same thing, that moral compass that helps them make good decisions within it. And one criticism I do hear when we have these discussions is that where is the atheist representative on the panel? So when it comes to the concept of heaven and hell, what should somebody who doesn't believe in God at all make of these concepts that sometimes sound like stories?
You know, I would say atheists are very good people to talk about heaven and hell. And one of the greatest Islamic theologians and greatest sages, who I'm very fond of, Rumi, he would say about these matters hereafter, he has his famous utterance, sell your cleverness and buy bewilderment. Through cleverness, we can never really quite understand. Using our senses, we can never really understand the afterlife. It is a different level altogether. It requires higher consciousness. It's not about being of this religion or that religion, believing in God or not believing in God. There's a very famous Islamic story of a very just and pious king who has a wonderful relationship with a holy man, and this holy man is on his deathbed. And the pious king goes to him and says, oh, holy person, the light of splendor is going to shine on you very soon. When you step into that light, into the presence of God, please do me a favor. Please remember me to God. And the holy man says, Your Majesty, when I step into that light in the hereafter, I won't even remember who I am. How can I remember you? So all this is conjecture that we're talking about the afterlife.
And, you know, I think that I'm glad you brought that up, because we feel, the three of us, that there are many different spiritual paths. I mean, we represent three traditions that have lots of similarities. But atheism is a spiritual path. It gives life meaning and purpose. And we honor those things as long as they seek to contribute to the common good and so forth. And so I don't think that particulars of our traditions necessarily relate that much to the larger question of what happens when the body dies. That's a universal question that any human being can not only ask, but seek an answer to.
One of the peculiarities of Judaism is that Judaism has always encouraged scientific pursuits, creative thinking, It's not a particularly theological religion. It's not a religion that is specifically focused on afterlife, even though those are questions that come up in, you know, for human beings. So they are talked about and dealt with. It is possible to be Jewish and an atheist. There's nothing in tradition that says you're not allowed to do that. There are groups of humanistic Jews who don't believe in God, but they believe in community, they believe in family, they believe in the ethical principles of Judaism, you know, which is probably the tradition they're born into. So there are things that are important to them, but theology is not one of them. But the nature of human being and the nature of life is something that all of us deal with, whether or not we're members of any tradition or members of any faith. And one of the difficulties we get into is some understanding of some faiths sound like those faiths are exclusivist, saying, listen, the only way to get to heaven is through belief, for example, belief in Jesus. The only way to get to heaven is through, you know, a particular belief, a particular tradition. And I think those are unfortunate because they're power plays. They're not really dealing with the reality of spirituality, which is always inclusive. True spirituality is never exclusive.
When you picture your afterlife, is there one particular image that pops into your head?
You know, whenever I think of the afterlife, I love to quote that mystical saying that points to the extraordinary, exquisite joy the soul feels in returning home. And in Islam, we have reincarnation, but in different levels of what we call levels of heaven, all going towards union with God. So I love this verse that says, a lovesick nightingale among owls, you caught the scent of roses and flew to the rose garden. So I don't fear death. I know the afterlife is I go to the rose garden and then to the maker of the rose garden. And that's a very, very good feeling.
That's Imam Jamal Rahman. He's co-founder, Muslim Sufi minister at the Interfaith Community Sanctuary and adjunct faculty at Seattle University. Pastor Don McKenzie, what do you think?
Well, you know, I mean, I think we have to confess that we project our own experience onto this whole topic. But I think that if there's anything I feel as certain about as possible, it is that whatever now feels broken, wounded, or lost will be put back together, brought home, healed, and so forth. Because I think all of our traditions suggest the Holy One of Being wants healing for all of creation, not just for a part of it.
Pastor Don McKenzie, former minister, head of staff at University Congregational United Church of Christ in Seattle. And Rabbi Ted Falcon, we end with you.
I have a suspicion that some of the states that I have discovered in meditation are hints of existence that is not attached to a body. And it's a different kind of existence. In the body, what we do with our consciousness matters in terms of the world we live in and the kinds of lives we lead. You know, our thoughts do impact our reality, but they do so slowly because this is a material world and it's hard to push that kind of substance. In an existence without the resistance of materiality, my suspicion is that what the mind does is perceived as real more quickly. I believe that what people will experience as either heaven or hell really has a lot to do with what they're doing in their consciousness and what they're expecting. My suspicion is that I'll be learning the same things that I'm trying to learn now, that I will be doing that learning on a different level, and hopefully I will be learning more quickly to let go of grievances, to let go of blame, to let go of resentment, and to open more fully to the love which is the essence of our being.
Rabbi Ted Falcon is teacher of Jewish meditation and spirituality. He is the founder of Makom Or Shalom, a synagogue in Los Angeles, and Beit Aleph Meditative Synagogue in Seattle. Together with the three Interfaith Amigos, thank you, gentlemen, for coming in.
Thank you, Katie.
Thanks. Thank you, Katie.
This is Weekday.
Coming up, We're going to talk with Vaughn Palmer with News from Canada. What makes a good director? What do we mean when we say a film is well directed? Robert Horton will kick that around with you. And then John Talton. We'll talk about what we get paid and what that means in today's economy. All that and much more. Well, not much more. All that, but we'll fill in the blanks. That's coming up on Weekday.
KUOW 94.9, news and information.
Support for
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.